WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Americans may prefer to talk about health care during Congress's August recess, but we are also being forced to talk seriously about Afghanistan. July was the deadliest month for coalition forces in Afghanistan since 2001. There were 74 killed, including 43 Americans. This month brings presidential elections to the country. Insurgents are targeting candidates and others to try and disrupt the voting. We've heard about some of those deaths already. So watch out between now and August 20th when that balloting takes place. We will talk about Afghanistan and more now with a very special guest to begin today's program, General Tony Zinni, who was the commander-in-chief of CENTCOM, the U.S. Central Command, in the 1990s. He was an early skeptic of the Iraq War by way of background, but also served as special envoy to the Israelis and Palestinians under President Bush. He was a leading candidate for ambassador to Iraq under President Obama. He is president for international operations of MIC Industries, which makes machines that help build buildings. And General Zinni has a new book called Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. General Tony Zinni, thank you for coming back on WNYC. Hello.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be with you.
First, as far as you could tell from where you sit, why was July the deadliest month for U.S. troops in Afghanistan since 2001?
Well, I think several reasons. One, we obviously increased the troop presence, and we're going into areas and intend to hold those areas that the Taliban control. So I think everybody expected that the fighting would pick up and the intensity would be much greater. And, of course, as you mentioned, the elections are coming up, too. So that's another factor in stirring the pot. And this time of year in Afghanistan is usually when everybody goes on the offensive.
In your book, you call the war in Afghanistan, quote, a growing disaster and a dangerous cancer metastasizing into Pakistan and Central Asia. Do you feel that it is that under President Obama as well as it was that under President Bush?
I think what's happened now is obviously we're taking the war much more seriously. I think Iraq was a distraction for all the reasons that you know well. The commitment now is to resolve this before it actually spreads and becomes worse, and we could see what was happening in Pakistan. I think the commitment of troops, the leadership lineup is outstanding in terms of our Pentagon leadership and our generals in the field out there. But it's going to take regional cooperation, the Indians, Pakistanis, Afghans, and it's going to take an international commitment. We've seen that not all the NATO forces have the same level of commitment as we do, the Brits do, Canadians, Dutch, and so I think the big task ahead, although I think President Obama sees what has to be done, is getting that kind of regional and international commitment and, ensuring that the American people understand this is going to be several years before we get it to a position where we have a stable Afghanistan and a stable Pakistan.
Well, what do you see as the mission? How will we know victory in Afghanistan when we see it?
Well, I think we have to be careful about how we define victory. I think we need to keep our sights reasonably low. We want a reasonably stable Afghan government, and we want a stable Pakistan, certainly. I think we'll know victory in several respects. One, obviously, our mission is to get al-Qaeda They are the perpetrators of 9/11, and that still is the primary mission, as this administration has said. We need to neutralize the Taliban. I think some of the Taliban may be reconcilable. From my understanding of things on the ground, not all Taliban are alike. Some are hardline ideological. Others may be just villagers who don't want you around with the right incentives, the right cooperation, much like happened in Iraq with the Sunni insurgents, might be able to be weaned away. So I think victory will be defined by reasonably stable, viable Afghan and Pakistan security capability to manage it, some incentives on the ground so that tribal leaders are pulled away from extremism, and it'll probably involve some economic cooperation and support. But again, we're not going to implant Jeffersonian democracy, free market economies, or anything like that, and we shouldn't think in those terms.
But just to keep our eye on the ball, if the ultimate goal is U.S. security and preventing another 9/11 and that kind of thing, then can escalating the war in Afghanistan really accomplish that goal? We've seen many empires, send armies that go to die in Afghanistan trying to control the culture there, the politics there. And terrorist organizations, if their goal is to attack the United States inside the United States, well, if Afghanistan doesn't remain a friendly place to hide, they'll go somewhere else. Or do you disagree?
No, I don't disagree, and I think you hit the nail on the head. Is we want them out of Afghanistan. I mean, it wasn't the Taliban that attacked us; it was the Taliban that were hosting those that attacked us.
Correct.
And I think we've got to turn Afghanistan into an unfriendly sanctuary, and keep limiting or eliminating the sanctuaries. I agree 100% that as soon as you shut down Afghanistan and Pakistan and other places as potential sanctuaries, you'll see them pop up in Somalia, Yemen, somewhere else. And so the problem's not going to be solved here. It's going to be solved by creating viable security forces, making sure that we stabilize parts of the world, and I think this is an international mission, not just a U.S. mission, so that these sanctuaries don't exist, or they're at least controllable by us. We're able to deal with them in some way. And that's going to be the challenge for this century. I mean, extremists will go where there aren't viable security forces, where there's not the kind of government structure and stability, where there is unrest amongst the people and maybe even a sense of sympathy or support. And we're going to have a process of trying to eliminate these sanctuaries or at least neutralize them.
So you think over a period of decades we're kind of going to be playing this game of whack-a-mole with terrorists in various unstable countries with American blood the price to pay?
I think you will be involved in it, but it may not all be in American blood or military operations. It may be where we see potential sanctuaries about to become ungovernable or sink into that sort of situation, where we may engage and help economically, help improve conditions. And again, when I say we, this shouldn't be the United States. This is a responsibility for the international community to ensure these kinds of hellholes
around
the world.
Because these attacks are taking place in London and Madrid and
Absolutely.
Bali and Mumbai and et cetera, et cetera.
That's exactly right. This is not a U.S. problem. And that's been part of the difficulty here is getting the attention and energizing the international community to cooperate and to get regional cooperation on some of these. And so I do think, now I don't think every place is going to involve U.S. troops in a war, but it will involve some degree of development and engagement and cooperation with and building regional capabilities to deal with this, where nations and regions can help themselves.
Retired General Tony Zinni, my guest on WNYC, former Commander-in-Chief of CENTCOM. His latest book is called Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. And you frame your book about leadership very much in the context of the 20 years since the Cold War suddenly ended in 1989. Do you think that the entire post-Cold War era has called for a different kind of leader, from those who had come before?
I think it does in some ways. I mean, obviously, some of the basic principles of leadership are timeless, but I think that it's a much more confused world, and it requires a leader that can understand the world he or she lives in. You can't just think that your part of the world, whether you're in business, the military, whatever, is very limited and narrowly defined. There's just too many cross currents now. And I think we've lost the ability to think strategically, and there's a resurgence or a renaissance in strategic thinking. I think people want leaders that communicate, that have a degree of charisma, that are accessible and approachable. So in the book, I list about 11 things I see in leaders today that are successful that sort of have become hallmarks of successful 21st century leadership.
Funny enough, Donald Rumsfeld thought that even though he was in his 70s, that he was one of those new leaders pushing for a light, mobile, quick strike, postmodern kind of U.S. military. Why did his leadership on Iraq turn into such a disaster, in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, he didn't understand the environment he was thrusting our forces into. By the accounts of many of us who've been in the region, this was not going to be easy. If you didn't seal the borders, control the population, if you didn't understand how fragmented and fragile the population was, you were going to get into trouble. And the war plans before his required 380,000 to 400,000 troops. People realized that this was a big demand on the foot soldier, if you will, in this kind of environment. And I think his idea of light, fast-striking, swiftly resolving forces was just not applicable in this environment.
You used the New York Giants football coach, Tom Coughlin, as an example of how a leader can transform his style in the middle of his career. What's the Tom Coughlin story?
Well, he had issues with his players. He had a style that maybe was outdated because the game had changed, and he adapted. And there are many examples of that. Another great example is General Ray Odierno, our current commander in Iraq. This is his third tour there, and he's the first to admit that in the course of that time he adjusted and changed many of his views, opinions, approaches to the way he did business out there. And, good leaders adapt. That is probably the key.
How would you compare the leadership styles of Presidents Bush and Obama?
Well, I think obviously very different styles. I think you have in Bush a very sort of authoritative and centralized leadership style. I think in Obama it's much more delegating and participatory in the way he makes decisions and gets information. Obviously, Obama, has maybe more of a personal touch. He likes communicating. I think he's done more press conferences in the short time he's been in than the previous president. He's made some decisions that we have yet to see how they'll pan out. I mean, this idea of a team of rivals and setting up this structure of these special envoys, it's a very diffused and decentralized sort of policy-making apparatus. And it may not work. I mean, there's some issues and questions about that, but he's attempted a new design, if you will, structurally and organizationally. He's clearly stated his vision and his strategy, knows where he wants to go in places like Afghanistan and with the economy. But again, the proof's going to be on how it works out. I mean, in the end, a good leader is determined by how successful he or she is, and school's still out.
And General Zinni, you were President Bush's envoy to the Israelis and Palestinians for a time. Do you see any change in President Obama's leadership on that in a way that might bear any more fruit, whether it's the pressure on Israelis over the settlements, which is causing some backlash in the pro-Israel community, or anything else?
Well, I think one thing we're seeing is he's made a commitment to begin the involvement right at the start of his administration, and he's promised to stay with it. That will be key, because I don't see any quick solution. I don't think there's going to be a summit or a plan that's magically going to resolve this. I think it's going to have to be hard work and engagement over a set of years to resolve all the issues. You have not only the resolving of the issues that are out there that we all know, borders and right of return and settlements and all these other issues, but you also have the need, in the case of the Palestinians, say, for their government to evolve and develop their security forces. So the key here may be the willingness to invest time and to work all these issues, in a dedicated manner with people committed to it, rather than maybe just an envoy doing quick touch and goes, and when it doesn't go right, backing off. But a commitment to stay through it, even through the worst times. This is probably not the best time. Both governments have their own problems. There are issues on the table in the region that impact this, like Iran and others, that it doesn't make this the isolated one issue in the region. But I think that the key is the willingness to commit a full term of his presidency or two should he be reelected, and the determination to stay with it.
Just give me 30 seconds, if you even have 30 seconds, of a reaction on the push to stop the expansion of settlements. Is that the right place to put energy right now?
I think it's one of the places. Obviously, it's one of the final status issues. You can't determine borders until you resolve the issue of the settlements. There's, of course, in the past been a lot of proposals going back from Prime Minister Barak and even Prime Minister Olmert that have offered solutions on borders and land compensation. And the settlements are all part and parcel of that. Now, settlements aren't the only issue.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, there's the issue of violence and the control of violence. There's the issue of water, the issue of Jerusalem,
and on,
right
and on,
of return.
And on. Let me get one in before we run out of time. One more, because you write in the book about how the military during the 60s and 70s did well at leadership change to incorporate civil rights, women in the military, the baby boomers' generational values, cultural change. Are they ready now to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell and incorporate another kind of civil rights?
Well, first of all, I would say the kind of military we're going to have, the kind the American people want, insist on, and through their political leaders, they'll do it. My one caution would be when you impose significant change in the military, social change, having been through several of those, you have to think through it and make sure it's done in the right way, in a thoughtful way. You also have to make sure that you understand all the implications. You know, if civil society out here has not even resolved the issue of gay marriage, that impacts on the military because it impacts things like benefits and base housing and all sorts of other things. And if it's done, it should be done in a way where it has the least impact on readiness, on good order and discipline. We've been through the experiments where it's done by fiat or there's just an executive order, and the society hasn't sorted out, and then the military takes 30, 35 years of suffering through trying to do something that society hasn't adjusted to yet.
But if the political sector makes this decision, you think the military can make the adaptation?
Well, it will be difficult. I don't think we should underestimate that. I think everybody ought to be committed to understand how best to do it if that's a decision that's made.
Mm-hmm.
Think through every single issue.
All right.
And do it in a way that doesn't, you know, affect our readiness. Any social change in the military has an impact. We shouldn't kid ourselves, and we have to be prepared for it.
General Tony Zinni, his new book, Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And we recorded that interview with General Zinni earlier this week. Coming up next, a rebroadcast of our Aspen Ideas Festival event, Being Human in a Digital World. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.